I've heard more than one person speak of birth in relation to death and from a Christian perspective and how many parallels there are. You know, in both situations, you know, we're in a world that it's our entire world. It's all that we know, and we have no ability, you know, the babe has no ability to know what it's like outside the womb. And it has everything it needs within the womb. That is its universe, the sum total of its existence. And you know, the birth process, you know, isn't pleasant for the baby's side of things, nor for the mother's. But you know, when you look at, you know, but we know something the baby doesn't know, that its life will be richer and fuller. You know, there's none here, I think, that would want to revert themselves back to a baby and imprison themselves once again in the womb, having known the experience, even with the pain that we've known in this life. I don't think any of us would want to go back to that. And we here in this life, this is all we know. There's no way for us to see beyond the veil of death. And this is our universe. And we have everything we need, you know, to continue existing here. And so for us, the prospect of death is scary and unpleasant because we don't know what's on that other side. But even as, you know, ultimately, you know, the baby ought to trust us, but we can't communicate with the baby, so the baby doesn't understand. We ought to trust our father, though. We're in a better position than the baby is because we have no way of sending messages to the baby that the baby can understand and say, hey, we're waiting for you. We love you. We're going to take care of you. And you're going to experience a lot of amazing things. Even so, our father waits beyond the veil for us, saying, I love you. I'm here. I'm not going to let you hit the ground. I'm going to catch you. I'm going to take care of you. And there's so many amazing things I want to show you. Paul said of death, though, Pastor Weigel, he said that it wasn't death that bothered him, it was the idea of dying, you know. And the Apostle Paul kind of had a similar sentiment. He said, talking about the idea, you know, speaking in terms of dying and, you know, and then the resurrection, he said, it is not that I want to be unclothed, that is, you know, die and lose his body. He said, but that I want to be clothed upon. You know, he wanted to receive immortality. He wanted to receive that new life in God. He wanted the work completed. You know, death, you know, if we could have the new life without, you know, the glory without death, I would be in that line. But unless it so happens that the return of our Lord is during our lifetime, we all must face that passage. But we have the assurance that the baby didn't have. We have the assurance of a loving God who has told us we don't have to be afraid, that he's there waiting for us. And I think it's fascinating that, you know, when I'm just always blown away. We're reading through the Gospels and to hear the words of Christ, you know, in John when he says that they may be where I am also. Heidi and I hate being separated. For Heidi's convenience, I will often say to her, if you want, I can run and get the thing and come back. You know, like if something's needed from the store, she just frowns at me. I'm like, look, I'm just putting it out there. We don't like being separated. We like being together. And to think that my Lord feels that way about me, to me, that it's particularly amazing, because when I was 17, I was convinced nobody loved me, that there was no one who cared for my soul. And I remember sitting on the ground up against the H building during lunch break by myself. The high school I went to had 3,000 students. And because it was California, they didn't like building things multiple stories high. So the high school covers a huge amount of ground, lots and lots of buildings. If you have, and it really is a campus, you know. If you have a class, you know, if you had the class one side and you had the class on the other, you were going to be late. There was no way to physically, unless you had a car, there was no physical way you could get to the other side. And so I was just mentioning that because they had all these buildings and they gave them letter designations, and the one I was sitting by was H. It was a bright, sunny day. And I was sitting there just hurting, feeling so very alone. And this Korean girl walks by. A lot of Asians where I grew up. And in fact, the majority of real Christians were Koreans around there. You know, it's like I got this mindset that all Koreans were good Christian people because of my experiences with them. I realize that's not the case, but it's like I meet somebody who's Korean, and it's like there's this kind of like this bias that goes, oh, they're good people. I got saved in a Korean English church. But she came by, and she tossed this candy at me. Just tossed it to me and kept walking. She didn't say anything. And attached to the candy was a little card, and it said, "Smile, God loves you." And I remember, almost in anger, looking up and saying, "Do you? Do you?" And it was later that day, I was sitting in my room, and I had a gift Bible. It was published by World. It was one of those bonded leather gift Bibles. You can still get them at most of your Christian bookstores. They sell them in bunches, not very wide, red letter edition, King James. And it had been sitting on that shelf for years. Somebody had given it to me. I don't remember who. And I reached over and I grabbed it. And I said, "You say this is your word. I'm going to read this. I'm going to do what it says. And I'm going to believe what it says. We'll see." I was challenging him. I was angry. I was defiant. But I was desperate. I was in a situation where I was basically I wanted to make a choice here. Because to me, if I couldn't find an answer, then there was no more reason to continue. Best decision I ever made. Best decision I ever made. There's some funny things about that, because I started reading, you know, I was an avid reader, and like any book, I know everybody else skips some of the pages, like with the credits and everything. I read everything. I start with the cover, and I just keep going. I even read the afterword, and I read the little biography things. And if it has a dust jacket, I read the front and back. I read everything. So, start with the cover. You open it up, and you just start reading. Go over table of contents, read the foreword, whatever's in there. So I just started reading. And I came to the part where God said that he gave to Adam every fruit-bearing tree and every herb of the field for food. And I stopped. And I was like, well, there ain't a single thing in there about meat. I was like, all right, I won't eat meat anymore. I was determined to do what it said. I won't eat meat anymore. So I became a vegetarian. That lasted a really short time because in chapter 6, you have the flood. Right after the flood, God says to Moses, I give, you know, you all the animals, you know, for meat. And I was like, all right. And I went and had a hamburger. Well, I'm really glad that at some point I figured out about the Old Testament, New Testament divisions. And so I started reading both of them at the same time because I was rapidly approaching animal sacrifice. So it's good I started reading New Testament. But I was so bewildered because a lot of the reason why people struggle in their understanding of the Bible isn't because the Bible isn't clear. It's because they have all these presuppositions. They're like, I mean, down to the very basic of definitions of what is good and what is evil. It's not the same thing. How the world defines most of its terms isn't even the same. That's why a worldly person reads the Bible and is absolutely bewildered because he goes with so many presuppositions. And the Bible's vast. It's not a small book. And there's so much that you have to compare and study and read. And it's talking about matters of eternity, so we should find them at times difficult to grasp a hold of because we are simply mortal men. And so I begged God. I said, please lead me to someone who can help me understand. And I was so lonely. And I said, Father, please give me godly friends. And so through some major dislocations in my life, he brought that about. But the whole thing is that what I found out is that card was true. That God does love me. And if I had understood things aright, the bright sun shining in the sky would have taught me that. The fact that breakfast that my mom made tasted oh so good. Should do that on Saturdays. Should make every once in a while. Make what we call mama's breakfast. Everybody nowadays would say it was really bad for you. Fried potatoes, bacon, fried eggs. But it was oh so good. We'd eat once. That was it. You'd just, you know, sit down, eat about 11 in the morning on Saturday, and you were done. You didn't eat any more that day. It was that heavy of a meal. But if I had understood how to think, I would have saw God's love every time I turned around. When we talk about the transcendence of God, you know, I began this, you know, with Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, where God told Moses, I am. That he was declaring that he existed without reference to anything else. You know, in grammar, they always talk about that when you add words with a verb, the verb to be, you know, that you are limiting it. It limits the scope of the verb. And you do that every time you add a word to a verb. You know, like, I hit the ball. You have limited the scope of the action to the ball. And so, you know, I could just imagine, you know, God says, you know, Moses is like, who are you? What's your name? What do I tell them so that they will know what kind of God you are? Now, names are just random sounds that people like. But names were always given in the ancient past because of what they meant. And I spoke before about the fact that deities, their names always referenced what they had domain over. When you are saying the word thunder, you are also saying the name of a pagan deity. In Old English, the word thunder was Thunar. And that was the name of the god of storms. And you had the same thing in Germany. You know, the god of storms was Donner. And even to this day, Donner means thunder. And so you have that again and again and again. You know, if you ever heard the Greek goddess Gaia, Gaia is just Greek word for the earth. And you have that. And so I can just imagine Moses, you know, God says, I am. That I am. Okay. And he goes, and what's interesting about that is because he understood that, because God says, tell them, I am hath sent you. And that it was understood that it was not being treated as a noun, but as the verb itself. When he went and told Israel who sent him, he conjugated the verb. He said, he has sent me. God said, I am, and he went to Israel, and he said, he is. And this idea, you know, if we could just grasp a hold of this and understand this, we would have a fuller picture of God, and we wouldn't be as afraid of the uncertainties of this world, this life. Last couple weeks, we've been talking about how that God, to just put it simply, that God is great. But not just that he is great, but that he is greatest. That there is none more powerful, more capable than God. Well, you have another way that you can talk about things. Because that's talking about measurements, capacities, you know, how big it is. Another way to put it in technical terms is you're talking about its magnitude. There's another way of talking about it, and that is its quality. How good is it? Good, better, best. And because God told Moses, I am, we must understand that when it comes to God's quality, he is that which is best. The Romans used to say of their chief deity, you've often heard the name Jupiter. That's not a name. That's a contraction. Jupiter is Jovis Pater. And Jovis, in English, we often say Jove. But you don't have a J sound. This really got me kind of excited one point because I studied Latin for 4 years. And after I started following Christ and I learned that in Hebrew that you call, that what God, you know, when Moses said he is, that he was saying Yahweh. Some argue as to how it should have properly been pronounced. You know, they say it might have been pronounced Yahweh. But I got so excited by that because there is no, the V in Latin is actually the letter U. And the letter U can be used both as a vowel and a consonant in Latin. And when it's used as a consonant, it is closer to the way the Spanish do the letter B and the letter V. It's kind of like almost like a W sound. It's a bilabial, you know. And so the reason I'm getting there is because if you were to say, you know, call upon Jove in the direct address form, you would say, O Jove. And that caught me off guard, and I was like, because I was a big student of mythology, and I knew that in the older stories of the Roman mythology, that the picture of Zeus, that he was truly like this all-powerful, omnipotent god, and then that they over time multiplied their deities. And they called him, they had this temple, this huge statue of him. It was one of the ancient wonders. And they had written, inscribed, Maximus et Optimus, greatest and best. See, what I'm convinced that in each of these pagan religions, you look back far enough, and they have this idea of a chief deity, uncreated, all-powerful, that at one point they knew the truth, and that over time they corrupted it. And I believe that at one point, Jove was the living God, but they corrupted his image and made him like a man. But that phrase, greatest and best, is only truly applied to God, because he is not a man. He's not a man, you know, bound by the limitations of this universe. You know, I have a coworker who always, he's like, anytime you bring up where he hates being told that he did something wrong or that he could do something better, and he always says, well, I'm just doing the best I can. Just doing the best I can. You know, and maybe he is. But our best sometimes is a rather paltry thing, because we're limited in our capacities, our understandings, our character. But God stands outside this universe, unlimited, infinite, transcending. I like the word transcending rather than infinite, because like we said before, infinite is negative, whereas transcending means to exceed, to go across. That word trans, that is the Latin word across. And it's that idea of going across any boundary, any border, bursting that box to pieces, not able to be contained. And God, you know, when we talk about the word best, we often use it in a comparative sense, measuring one thing against another, and we say, well, one person said that when you use the word best, you're normally talking about three or more things. Because if you were talking about two things, you'd say better. And so when you're saying best, you're talking about three or more things. But when we apply the word best to God, we're using it in an ultimate sense. That in comparison to anything, he is that which is best, absolutely. That there can be no improvement of his existence. Because if he could be improved, that would imply a limitation or demand a limitation. But he exists by his own declaration that he stands outside this universe unlimited. And that includes his quality, that he's not just simply the greatest, he is the best. I titled this message, The God of Love, because I argue that this concept of best and love as it is defined in the Bible, and this is where you always have to define your terms. I used to take part in debate a lot, and I love debate. I did very well. And one of the things I did was I always defined terms. Because you can't have communication without a definition of terms. Early on, I learned that what this one gentleman said, I forget who said it, but I found it to be absolutely true. He said that there is, you know, the definition as it occurs in the dictionary. There's the definition as it occurs in your local culture, and there's the definition as you use it. That often when people use words, they don't mean the same thing. I was listening to two people argue about whether or not women should be missionaries. And I was carefully listening, and I said, I think you guys need to define what you mean by a missionary, because you're saying some of the same things. And it turned out that they had the exact same position. I mean, exactly the same position, but they understood the word missionary as meaning two different things. So, definitions, very important. And I want to talk a little bit about how the Bible uses the word love differently than English does. I had a foreigner say to me one day, and at first I was kind of startled in a kind of like, what are you talking about sense, is he said, love doesn't mean anything in English. I was like, what? What are you talking about? And he said, well, you love sports, you love your wife, you love your dog, you love hot dogs, you love everything. So it doesn't seem to really mean anything. And I got to thinking about it. I was like, you know, I think he's right. I think that love doesn't really mean much in America and how we use the word. It just means, in fact, it's strictly emotional. In normal usage, it just means I have a positive emotion about something. But how the Bible uses it is, it's in fact, you have two different, there are people who try to argue that you have two different words that are normally used in the Greek New Testament that are translated love in English. Philia and agape. And they'll try to say that there is no distinction, but they're wrong. Not only do you find that there is a distinction in Greek usage, you know, in secular Greek usage, but the Bible makes a clear distinction between them. One of the most telling things is that the noun, the noun that indicated the receiver of love for philia was philos, and it meant friend, one's friend. It has that idea of affection. You know, when Christ said to Peter at the end of John, he says, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, I love you, Lord. Feed my sheep. Then he asks him again, Peter, do you love me? He says, I love you, Lord. Just feed my sheep. And he says third time, Peter, do you love me? Lord, you know all things. You know I love you. He says, feed my sheep. And I wondered, was Peter just getting exasperated because he asked him three times in a row? But then when I studied Greek and I studied that passage, I was startled by something because he changes words. Christ says, do you agape me, Peter? And he says, I philia you, Lord. Feed my sheep. Peter, do you agape me? I philia you, Lord. Feed my sheep. Peter, do you philia me? He changed it. The third time, he came down to where Peter was. Peter was unwilling to declare agape. He instead insisted on philia. And the third time, Christ brought it down and said, do you at least, basically, you know, like, you know, to put it in English parlance, be like, Peter, do you love me? I like you. Peter, do you love me? I like you. Peter, do you like me? And then Peter, hearing that coming back from Christ, says, look, you know everything. You know I like you. Some want to be harsh on Peter because of his response, but the man was dealing with the fact that he had just not long before betrayed him. He had previously made all kinds of bold statements. Maybe he was just afraid of him, of his own infidelity, that he didn't want to lie. He didn't want to be put in a situation where he was overstating the truth. I don't know. I'm not going to judge the man. But this concept of love is so different from the way we use it. Love is, in its action, in the sense of action, it is that which is best. We see that in passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 13. It talks about, you know, when you go through chapter 13, it says love is patient, it is kind, and then it talks about that it's not proud, it's not self-assertive, it's forbearing. It's always other-focused. But you always find that as it is used in a biblical sense, you know, in relation to God and godly conduct, it is always used in seeking that which is best for the individual. In James, let me see here, is it James? No. 1 John 3:17. It says, but whoso hath this world's good and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? So we see here that if you see somebody have a need, a lack of some kind, and you don't meet that, that you don't really love him. That love, the love in that has God uses the word. And he says, how dwelleth the love of God in him? That love is seeking to meet that need. Most famous verse in the world, John 3:16. I don't have it in the list, but Chris, why did I say Chris? Seth just gave me he stuck his thumb out and went like this because I gave him a list of verses so he could put them up, and now I'm referencing a verse that he doesn't have on his list. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Real quick, word so. Not used in the sense of like intensive and like how much, but in what way. The underlying Greek word makes that absolutely clear. It's a verb form, houtos, not adverb, I mean, houtos, which means this way, this, thusly. So, for God thus loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. So how did he show he loved the world? That he gave his Son to give the, you know, whoever believes in him life. So God sought what was best for everyone in the world. Romans chapter 5, again, more verses not on the list. It says that no greater love hath man than this, than that a man die for his friend. But God commendeth his love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were the enemies of God, God saw our need. The Bible declares that we all existed in death. I'm going to go way over. Is this a problem? That we all existed in death, and God saw that need, and he met that need because of love. God showed his love. His love is that which is best. Love, biblical love, is not fondness. It is not that feeling of affection. Scientists, you know, they say that love exists for a year. But what they're talking about is that, I call it the bubble. What I always tell, if somebody asks me or talks to me about it, what I always tell young people when they're first checking each other out, I always say, wait for the bubble to pop. And they're like, what do you mean? I said, as nice as they are, as great as they are, that super excitement you're feeling has nothing to do with them. You're just excited that you're in a relationship. That will go away. Wait for that to go away so that you can really look at the person and see, do I have a true relationship with them? Is this a person that I can walk hand in hand with for the rest of my life? See, I have a deep and abiding affection for Pastor Weigel. Before my life got really busy and complicated, I called him like every day for a while. Because I told him one day, I said, I have the relationship with you I always wanted with my own dad. You know, just a deep and abiding affection for Pastor Weigel. But that is not biblical love. Biblical love is separated from emotion, because how can you say love your enemy if it's an emotional response? How, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, they're like, how can I control my emotions? Well, emotions happen, I say. you can't allow emotions to dictate conduct. What we're talking about, you know, emotion is, love is always talked about how it acts, and it always acts in the best interest of the one loved. So love is, as they used to always say, the summum bonum, the greatest good. Love is that which is best. So going back to what I said before about God, if God is that which is best, we should find that in Scripture. Right? Now, I have established for you that God, that love is that which is best. So we turn to 1 John 4:16. And we have known and believed the love of God that God hath to us. God is love. And he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, and God in him. This is an amazing statement. Notice it did not say, I know in English nowadays, lazy English, we say drive safe instead of drive safely. That we don't care about the distinction of nouns and adjectives and adverbs anymore, and we just stumble our way and fumble our way through, and you know, as we, you know, collapsing in our ability to communicate, we say, you know what I mean? if he was talking about something that was simply descriptive of him, he would have said, God is lovely. God is loving. Some form that turned it into an adverb or an adjective to make it descriptive. But rather, he used the noun, the name of the very concept that he drew an equality between the concept of love, that which is best, and God. It's not just that God always does good things, or that we can measure him against some independent standard and look at him and say, yeah, he measures up. He's pretty good. But he is the standard. He is the concept. He is that which is best. And because he is that which is best, he is always motivated and moved. The reason he does everything, every word that comes from him, every action he takes, is motivated by one thing and one thing only, and that is love. Jesus Christ declared that all of the law is derived from two commandments. In Matthew 22, 36 through 40. It says, Master, which is the great commandment in the law? You know, he's asking, you know, what's the greatest commandment? You know, what has the highest rank? Jesus said unto him, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these, this is the part I want you to pay attention to listen, to drag it down in your thinking. Every time you read the Bible, say, remember this verse. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Every prophecy, every commandment had as its motivation love. God says, even the rain shows forth his love. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 through 48, he says, ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. That's what the rabbis taught. It says, but I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. And here's his reason. He says, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. We need the sun and the rain. Without those two things, the world would die. Everything on it would die. You know, in Washington State, Western Washington, how many of you here have you ever been to Western Washington? The most beautiful place in the U.S. But it's cloudy all the time. Seattle has more cloudy days than any city in the country. Like over two-thirds of its days throughout the year are cloudy days. People get depressed a lot in Washington. It's a real problem. Alcoholism and drug abuse are real problems in Washington, and they link it to this idea of people being depressed all the time because you don't get to see the sun. You should see Washington when the sun comes out. People go nuts. Everybody's outside. You make jokes, you know, like people make jokes in Washington. Somebody will say, I saw the sun today. Somebody will respond, sun? What is this that you speak of? You know, I've heard people do that. You know, it's just, unless you've lived there, you know, it's mist, it's misty, it's wet, it's gray, everything's green. Like your windows, the windows in your house, can't have, you have to be careful because they'll mold. The glass will grow mold because it's dark and wet all the time. It's just, you can't put anything against the walls. The walls will rot. It's damp, damp, dark, cold, cool. It's cool. It's like mid-50s year-round. I love the place, but a lot of people can't stand the lack of sun. But without, you know, water is the medium in which life occurs. Biological life. You can't have water and life. You know, I mean, you can't have the lack of water and life. You know, you will die. And so God, he says, my love I show to everybody. I do good to everyone. I am motivated. My every action is motivated by love. God said to Israel, in the midst of his law, in which he's detailing all these commandments, he cries out, oh, that there were such an heart in them. This is Deuteronomy 5:29, by the way, for Seth's sake. Oh, that there were such an heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. He says, I want it to be well with you. In the prophets, I didn't include this verse, but I've always remember it because to me it just shows, you know, people who are ignorant and want to tell lies about God and the Bible, they'll say, well, you know, the God of the Old Testament is all about judgment and harshness and no love. God cries out to Israel, oh, why will you die, O house of Israel? Pain, anguish. He didn't want to reject them. They rejected him. Jesus Christ, looking at the people who cursed him and said vile things about him and tortured him. And he said, O Jerusalem, O Jerusalem, how many times would I have gathered you under my wings like a mother hen her chicks? But you would not. You would not. So we find that he is not a cold, capricious, hard-hearted God, but rather that he is constantly, invariably, absolutely committed to the course of love. Somebody said that, you know, that God seems really vain and petty because he demands that people glorify him and worship him and come to him. But this is because, once again, this is why the lost person reads the Bible and is baffled. Because they don't understand. Think about the implications of this concept that God is that which is best. Then what, if God is that which is best, what's the best thing for you? What's the best thing that you could have? Him. He is that which is best. Why did God create the universe? Because the greatest thing that God could do, the best thing that God could do, because God is that which is greatest, God is that which is best, the best and greatest thing that he could do would be for you to experience him. This whole grand scheme of the creation of the universe, the play of sin and redemption, is all shouting out one thing: God is. Our almighty, all-powerful, loving God. No matter how many times I've rebelled against him, no matter how many times I've acted in gross ingratitude, he stands there, unchanging, faithful, and says, I love you, and nothing you can do will ever change that. Somebody said to me, they said, respect is earned, not granted. And I said, well, I was taught differently. I said, what do you mean? I said, I was taught that my treating you with respect has nothing to do with you. You could be the most vile, hateful person in the world. I will treat you with respect. Why? Because of who I am, not because of who you are. I am that kind of man. Today I had to discipline William. I hate doing it. I absolutely hate doing it. You know, God calls judgment his strange work. I hate doing it. It makes me cry. But I'm convinced it's the right thing. And if I'm convinced something's the right thing, I am not backing down. I sat him down, and I was breaking down, and I told him, I said, William, I don't like spanking you. I just want to hold you and kiss you and play with you. I said, but you need to learn to obey. It's right. And I'm not going to back down. And I think because I was upset, he turned towards me and Nick, because, you know, I don't think he was expecting that. And he looked really brokenhearted, and he threw his arms around my neck and clinging to me. And through my relationship with my son, I get a glimpse of the heart of God for me. That he doesn't want to chastise me. He wants to dump a big giant bucket of blessings on me. and smile and laugh and hug me and kiss me and tell me how much he loves me. But he knows what is best, because he is that which is best. And because he is so absolutely that which is best, he's not backing down. He will never give up on me. God is love. Lord God, we thank you for this time together. Thank you for your word. Thank you that you revealed yourself to us. Thank you that you had mercy on us in our lost estate. Oh God, I pray that you might use my stumbling efforts to glorify and magnify yourself, and that you might use your word, which has been declared, to transform each one of us into the very image of your Son. Oh Father, work now in each heart. there's any lost, I pray that they might be saved, and even now that they might be moved to call on you, and that the saved might be moved to a greater love and zeal for you. Use this time of invitation, O Lord, to glorify yourself, I pray. In the name of your Son, Jesus, pray these things. Amen.